Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address-based wormhole. I'm Ed Worley, and I'm here with my co-host, Tom Guffey.
Hey, Ed.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Sorry to cut you off.
No, it's all good. I'm actually going to interview Tom for this one, so I'm going to interview him for this episode. And we're going to talk about IPv6 address planning, because I think Tom knows a thing or two about this particular subject.
Yeah, why would we talk about that? I don't know. I'm trying to put a finger on why you would pick me to interview about that subject.
So, you know, for those that don't know, Tom wrote a book. It's actually called, it's a creative title. It's called IPv6 Address Planning. It's from O'Reilly Press. And, you know, we've also, I think one of the reasons that this comes up for me is that Tom and I often get a chance to lament on often what we call IPv4 thinking. And
that's right.
And IPv4 thinking is what predicated, I mean, I think it was even part of our original discussion about me teasing you into writing a book. I think I would say you would claim arm twisting. I think you said I arm twisted you into writing this book. But I think I would say I was teasing you into saying, like, hey, we have all these people that are thinking in a particular way around IPv4, and we wanted to talk through what that conversation was like and how you ended up basically writing the book. Maybe we'll start off with you quickly sort of introducing yourself and maybe sharing a little background, how you got involved with V6, and, you know, sort of work experience, things like that. So the folks get a feel for where your background comes from, and then we can maybe dive into that first part of it, which is that V4 thinking stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And a little bit more about your persuading me into doing the book, which was, you know, it was required. I wasn't fully convinced that I think I was convinced that the book needed to be written, but I wasn't fully convinced that maybe I'd needed to do it myself. and you were always very encouraging in that regard. And of course, you know, it was excellent having you as an editor as well. But yeah, thanks. Just a little bit of my background. I got involved with IPv6. I think initially it was really just studying for the CCIE back in the mid-aughts, and Cisco, you know, being forward thinking on all networking related technologies, actually had quite a bit of content in the CCIE routing and switching written and lab around IPv6. And this is probably like 2005, 2006 timeframe. I didn't actually successfully pass my lab when I sat it, but there was enough like foundational material in there that a few years later, when I was working at Limelight, of course, the content delivery network, one of Akamai's competitors, one of the projects that came up while I was there, which was probably circa 2008, was IPv6, and there were a number of engineers, network architects, engineers sitting around the table, and the boss was like, well, you know, here we've got these projects that we need to really get off the ground. One of them is multicast, and one of them is IPv6, and I kind of raised my hand. I'm like, yeah, you know, I remember IPv6 from the lab, studying for the lab, for the Cisco lab. And it was always pretty interesting, just like the address structure and, you know, just geeking out on the hexadecimal address representation and how all that worked, how address concatenation all sort of functioned and what the routing sort of looked like and how it was the same and how it was different. So I kind of volunteered to do the V6 deployment at Limelight Networks. And before I really realized what I was getting into at the time.
See, you could have chosen multicast.
I could have chosen multicast.
You could have been there with Shannon. Shannon was like, you know, it's Shannon McFarland over at Cisco, right? His curse is multicast, IPv6. He has this set that followed him throughout history. You could have had the same career path as Shannon.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and that's the thing. I don't know that. I think I'd probably... You'd probably be visiting me at my grave, the headstone that would just say IP PIM sparse mode on it, you know, just like that. That would have been, it just had the little bit of troubleshooting I've done around multicast. I think I got lucky with the V6 choice for the project.
Here lies IGMP V2.
that's right. Oh yeah. No, IGMP by all means, man, if it's on a single LAN segment or within a single collision domain, you know, just turn it on and it works. You know, it's just when you start getting into WAN multicast, it's just, oh my God, what a troubleshooting nightmare. Anyway, that's the road not taken. And so we'll just leave it at that. The PIM sparse distribution tree not joined, as it were. So then I started poking around and looking at what I needed to do to deploy IPv6. And of course, you know, sort of stepping through all the steps and the phases that we've been recommending over the years to folks that that are sort of following in those early footsteps of getting it deployed. And you know, one of the first steps, of course, is you got to have IPv6 addresses. And working for a service provider, you know, content delivery network, we got a gigantic global IP backbone, and we're running Brocade equipment and routing everything over, you know, BGP and ISIS, and going out and getting an address allocation. And at the time, the conventional wisdom was that you would need to get one from each of the regions you're operating in. And so, you know, we were in Asia and we were in Europe and North America as well. So I got a /32 each from Aaron, from Ripe, and from APNIC. So I'm sitting there with 3/32s and a very solid background in writing address architectures and network topologies for IPv4. And I don't even know where to begin. In the first, the first challenge was, I really had no idea how large of an address space the /32 was. Like a single /32, just, you know, I couldn't even really initially think of it, easily think of it as, okay, well, I've got 65,000 /48s in my /32, and each of those is 65,000 /64s, because, you know, and as we'll discuss at length, I think, in this podcast, but just the whole IPv4 thinking problem, right? It just really reared up and bit me in the behind, where, you know, just the idea that not even really being comfortable with the /64 being deployed on an interface. And so, and that was sort of, you know, just sort of doing the initial back of the napkin, sort of carving up the address space. I was definitely coming at it from the smaller subnet end of things, right? Coming at it from /64 and above. And of course, being completely agitated, sort of anxious, you know, in my own mind about using a /64 on an interface, because at the time, it was right around the time that we started seeing that issue with, it was more sort of widely reported around wanting to configure a /127 on a point-to-point link rather than a /64, which was the initial recommendation by the IETF. And so I think with Brocade, they were pretty quick to patch that particular issue, but at least initially Brocade was actually recommending, according to the IETF as well, go ahead and allocate a /64, configure a /64 on the point-to-point link. And so right away, you just lose your mind because you're just like, this is insane. What am I doing? I'm putting, you know, this, and at the time, I don't even think I knew the decimal expansion, like 1.8 times 10 to the 19th addresses. I'm putting that number of addresses. I just knew that it was a ton of addresses. Hopefully this is a family-friendly podcast, but I'm going to go ahead and use that to purple word there, or brown word, as it were. So, you know, I've got all these point-to-point links in the IP backbone, and we were running ISIS, and at that point it was single topology mode. And so we had, you know, some fun with that as well, where you go to put an IPv6 subnet on your WAN interface. And then, of course, as soon as you have an IPv6 as soon as you have an IPv6 routing table, you got to perform an SPF calculation. And if it's single topology mode, it's all one big SPF calculation. And, and you bring the IPv4 network to its knees, production network to its knees, because it's, you know, it's doing one large SPF calculation. Learned that one the hard way. And we didn't have good guidance from Brocade on that one. But we figured out how to sort of do that. You know, you could turn down the interface, put the IPv6 allocation on there, and then turn it back up. And then it would, even though you don't have IPv6, and this is, of course, the recommendation, if it's single topology mode, you got to have IPv6 running everywhere, or you'll end up with, you know, the SPF recalc, and you'll end up with a very spotty internal routing topology, and, you know, just what it actually looks like from the routing plane perspective. So yeah, sorting through all that and getting that, you know, getting the network, the core network, IPv6 deployed on the core network, that was actually one of the easier things. But in the process of doing that, just slicing and dicing those 3/32s and figuring out what would go where, and just really not having really any good guidance at all. I mean, we had the RFC that originally talked about that, the number of which escapes me at the moment. But, you know, sort of the general recommendations around what size allocations you should be using. It was right around that time frame that an excellent document came out from Surfnet, the European ISP, and I think Ripe kind of put their seal of approval on it. And it was, you know, it was basically how to do a V6 address plan. It was a shorter document. And that was really incredibly helpful And of course, what you're really missing and initially is just that the confidence level, since you're, you know, it's something entirely new with IPv6 and you're just not used to having that large of an address space to work with. And so you're sort of looking for someone to come along and say, hey, if you do it this way, you're gonna have fewer issues down the road. And not having that, you know, having to sort of redo the address plan two or three times, just based on some really fundamental errors where IPv6 is concerned. And I would say the biggest of those, since, you know, the biggest would, well, I don't want to give away the questions that you probably have as we go through the interview process. So it seems like a good place to pause, and you can sort of,
well, maybe this is the lead in on the V4 thinking side, because when you and I were first talking about this, and my biggest complaint when I was working, you know, consulting and working with customers is like, I have no document to share with them that's really comprehensive to explain the rat holes that we get into from a conversation basis to try and help them understand how big the address space is and how to actually do an address plan. And for me, when I look at an address plan in the V4 world, we actually care about hosts. Mm-hmm. In the V4 world, we care about how many hosts you're operating, where they're operating, what their serviceable functional role is, and all these sorts of weird things. And the reason why is because we have these, sort of what I consider unnatural constraints on us to have to carve up address space in order to fit these particular utility models of, I need this security boundary here. Well, we have very limited address space. We're going to carve it down something smaller than a /24 in the V4 space and give you a /29, or is it a /28? And it becomes unnatural because it's very hard to either grow the space up or even carve the space down further. But it certainly doesn't serve your network needs, because we're introducing more and more network configurations into your routing tables. You have to understand the security policies that go along with them. And it just becomes this like sort of ugliness that, and it simply has to do with the fact that we just don't have enough addresses to assign out, or enough networks, I should say, to assign out in V4. And that was, I think that was the predicated first portion of what we had spoken about, right? Mm-hmm. Saying like, hey, what was the point that you had the epiphany and the light bulb went off? And you're like, I don't worry about hosts anymore. I just have to worry about networks.
Right? Yeah, like, yeah, that's right.
I only have to worry about networks, and I got a lot of networks. I'm not going to use your word, but we got a lot of networks, literally an infinite number of networks for all practical purposes. And no one's asking me to put any constraints on how many networks I need to ask for. So, they can supply me as many as I need. Like, when has that ever happened? Like, I literally have an infinite supply of networks, and then each one of those networks can have an infinite number of end host devices. And it was just an unfathomable number. Because I remember when we were, you know, go back to your point-to-point thing. Oh my gosh, we're using a /64 on a point-to-point link. We only need two addresses for that point-to-point link. That's 2^64 minus 2. Yeah. Like, that's a really big number. But then I realized after sitting down and doing the math that 2^64 minus 10,000 is not a significantly statistically different number than 2^64 minus 2.
No, right? That's right. And that's exactly what I open my book with, which is just that calculation, right? And because it exists in like sort of two domains, right? There's the abstract domain where it's just a math problem, where it's just a division problem, not even a proper math problem for mathematicians, but, you know, just grade school division, where you've got an excessively large number, 1.8 times 10 to the 19th, and you're going to divide any number into that. And, you know, unless you're talking about astronomically large numbers, and that's where it goes into the practical domain, because we can't, you know, if we have a LAN segment, if we have a collision domain or a LAN segment or whatever, however we want to sort of characterize it, the number of hosts that we can put on that segment, the upper bound of that, right? I mean, what is that upper bound? And that was the light bulb moment for me, because I started thinking, well, how many hosts can I put on a single interface? Can I put, you know, I back in the day, it was sort of a block memory limit in the router, the switch. You know, maybe it was 64K, and then you start thinking, well, am I really actually, or what is the scenario where I'm going to have 64K hosts on this segment? Maybe in a virtualized environment, you might try to, you know, ramp that number up to something close to that. But even there, I don't think it becomes manageable beyond a certain point. So, whatever that number is, it's probably in the thousands range. Maybe it's in the 10,000s range if you really want to, you know, sort of torture the thought experiment. But no matter how large you make that number, I can make it a million, I can make it 10 million, I can make it a billion, because really then we're talking about scientific notation, and we're talking about going from, you know, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 12th. Well, we're, you know, we start out at 1.8 times 10 to the 19th. So it's just like you're never going to consume any significant portion of that, the addresses, the host addresses that are available on a LAN segment with the standard /64. It's just, so forget it. It's like right away, you just have to start from the premise that there's just no such thing as host address conservation. Now, backing up from that, if I'd sort of, it's kind of hard to sort of read between the lines sometimes with RFCs and sort of what the IETF was thinking. But the other way to put it, and maybe this is a shorter path to get there for some folks who are still sort of laboring with this IPv4 thinking that we're describing. But the other path to it is just to recognize that, you know, V6, right away we're taking half of the address space and we're throwing it away on what we call the interface identifier. Not throwing it away, but it's being used for that. You know, we've already started built into the very design and thinking of behind that design of the protocol with reserving 64 bits for the interface identifier. So you're not really, it's not possible to waste that space given that that's a part of the original design of the protocol. But just whatever path it takes you working with IPv6 to get to that point where you just accept that you have a virtually unlimited resource. As far as, you know, the host address side goes, it's absolutely unlimited. And then you start thinking about, okay, well, I'm going to start going back. And when I say going back to thinking about consuming IP address resources in terms of subnets, because we are really sort of going backwards there. So if you go back to the early days of the internet and IPv4, we started out with classful addressing, right? And it wasn't, you know, at the time it was sort of considered necessary because you wanted a trade-off between the amount of processing that you needed to do when you're doing, you know, routing summarization or any sort of security processing. You needed a sort of neater boundary to make that calculation a little easier and save some of your CPU and your memory. And, you know, because in those days it was much more expensive, router memory was much more expensive. But that's the sort of physical world aspect of it. The more abstracted version of that is that you can really think about your network in this very tidy way where you have these very consistent subnet sizes. And that was sort of the original idea. Like if I had a big network, maybe I get a class A, you know, I get a /8 from the internet registry. If I have a smaller network, maybe it's a /16. If I have, you know, a small network, then maybe it's a /24. Well, obviously we just didn't have enough bits to have that model scale to provide all the growth that we needed for the internet. But so V6, we're sort of returning to the ability to be able to do that. And so the reason I'm sort of mentioning that historical aspect of it is that now if I figure out, you know, I'm thinking about the total number of prefixes that I need. And if I start with, say, you know, the basic rule that a /48 is reserved for a site, for a single site, and I sort of go up from there. Well, okay, a /48, if I go to a /44, that's basically 16 /48s, or /40, that's 256 /48s, /36, that's 4096 /48s, or /32, that's 65,000 /48s. And so right. I'm doing this exercise where I just basically, instead of increasing the granularity of the allocations based on subnetting smaller and smaller subnets, I go the opposite direction. I do supernetting, and I, you know, so if I realize that I have a certain number of networks that I need to number into, and that number, however arbitrarily large that number is, I just basically throw whatever that size allocation is at the problem to make it go away. So if it's if I have more than 65,000 /48s that I need, and I get to decide what that, you know, how I'm using those, then I just go back to the rear and I say, hey, I need more address space. I need I could go jump to the next nibble boundary. And of course, we have to talk about that a little bit as well, but go from a /32 to a /28, and I have 16 /32. So each of those /32s has 65,000 /48. So 16 times 65,000 /48s. But the rear is not going to blink at that request. They're not going to hesitate to give me that requested space because they want me to have the address resources that I've decided that I need to number into my network with IPv6.
Yeah, and it's really tough. That's the other side is that in the past, for those that were experienced network operators who work with arrears, getting V4 space was an actual process, painful process, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Painful process within the last few years for the simple reason, well, actually, it's really, really painful now because we're out of V4.
That's
but
right.
Leading up to that particular sort of state of affairs for us, I think that was what, 2015, that was sort of the burn down. The reality is, you had to do weird justifications, you had to show them how many hosts were utilizing everything. There was like all these criteria requirements to qualify for, this /24 or /23 or /22. And you thought you want some, super, you should get like a Superman award for like getting through the process with because they had to do all sorts of due diligence, and they came back and audited you again to make sure you were using the address space. If you weren't, they were taking it back. Like it wasn't permanently yours really in that state until you could really show that you were using it. There was all sorts of weird things that went along with it. That just felt downright intrusive in some ways.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was, it was part of the community to help address, to help conserve V4 address space, and V6, just all of that is jettisoned. There is zero reason to think that you will get any sort of pushback in regards to how your address plan need requirements. As long as they're reasonable, you can't just pull it out of thin air, but you do have to be able to write something down that's articulate. But having something that's reasonable, that supports your business plan, not mm-hmm. your technical needs, your business plan, about mm-hmm. where your business plan and growths are, they will just be like, hey, let's get this stuff done. Let's get you the address space you require for making that work, and you're off to the races.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely it. And it's kind of paradoxical, right? Because if you think about the rears and interacting with the rears and all of the persnicketiness that they brought to your IPv4 plan and making sure that you had gone, you were very accurate in terms of what you thought your consumption levels would be. And again, in terms of the efficiency of the plan, that was very much measured on at the IPv4 host level, like the host addressing level, as opposed to the subnet level, just because we were in such a conservation crouch related to IPv4. And that's really reinforcing IPv4 thinking. And this is not the fault of the rears. They're just protecting a shared community resource. So it's kind of like going from, like a fossil fuel economy to fusion power, right? I mean, just like just having basically a boundless supply of something, and nobody's really used to that. And an analogy I think is kind of useful in that regard. Like there's that, famous sort of story about the grandmother, who's showing her grandson how she makes a fish, And so she takes the fish and she cuts the head off and the tail off, and she puts it in the pan. And the grandson says, in his naive ways, like, why do you cut the head and the tail off? The pan's plenty big enough to fit the fish. And the grandmother says, well, I don't know. We've just kind of always done it this way. Back in the day, there was a reason for that. The pan was too small. And so you cut the head off of the fish and the tail off of the fish so that it actually fit into the pan. Now you've got a big enough pan and you're still cutting the head and the tail off of the fish. And so it's that, the variable length subnet masking is the knife, as it were, in this regard, and the allocation is the fish, and so what we're doing with VLSM and IPv4, we're just like constantly shaving it down to make sure that we're not wasting host addresses. And that is the sinister aspect of V4, because what happens is now I don't have to worry about that. I've just got a standard size subnet, and I'm just going to throw whatever that is, the largest size site that I might have from a network standpoint, I just assign that a large enough subnet or prefix that it's more than enough to address into that, for that. And then even if I have a smaller site, I use the same size prefix.
Totally weird thinking, right? Well, here's the other thing. We were also used to V4 thinking we had to dive deep in this rat hole of technical thought. What's the right subnet space? How do we carve this up? Did you do something cool with /30? Oh, we came up with /31 to make it even better.
That's right. And that was really slick, right? Because now I can do, twice as many point-to-point links, out of a /24. And that's great. So like the nibble boundary, that's the next thing to mention, because that's one of the ones that's sort of another hurdle to overcome in your IPv4 thinking. You automatically are so used to just peeling off an extra bit to do your subnetting. Oh, I'm going to go from a /30 to a /31, and I'm going to double my subnet space size. well, we just do away with that altogether in IPv6. There's no reason at the beginning, and maybe there'll be a reason down the road, you know, maybe within your own network, you find yourself space constrained and then you want to start, you know, doing individual bits, subnetting based on individual bits. But until that day down the road, do everything on nibble boundaries, because that makes every character in my IPv6 prefix significant, right? If I'm identifying a location or a particular network, if I've used that nibble boundary, that means I can look at that prefix and know exactly where that prefix lives, because all of those characters in the prefix will be significant based on the nibble that I chose to round it off to. And this is incredibly powerful, right? I mean, I don't have to worry about carving up the space in between the nibbles. And right. In doing that, I'm actually leaving myself a huge amount of space to number into down the road if I need to be able to do that, you know, down the road. If, let's say, you know, for whatever reason, I feel like I'm space constrained.
Yeah. 150 years when you're, yeah. I mean, that's the other funny thing is these conversations are like, with business planning folks, you're like, do you have a plan for 150 years about what your network needs to look like? You look at me like I'm crazy. Like, I don't have a plan for 10 years. So, you know, trying to submit a business plan that talks about where you're going to be that for far down the road. And I think that's the same thing with the nibble boundaries. I'm like, really? Yeah. Are we really going to go there? Right? Like, you got so much boundless, you know, network address space to work with. Like, stop worrying about that. Start worrying about other things, like free up and go the other direction and don't constrain yourself that way.
That's right.
A good place for math, if folks really want to get into that. Actually, Joe Davies does a good job in his Understanding IPv6 third edition of doing all the bit level math that you need to do bit level to hexadecimal. That mm-hmm. sounds like fun. It sounds like fun, everyone.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Go from binary up to hexadecimal, and then do your subnetting, and then do the breakdown, and then he breaks all the math down there so you can do it. Let's make your life easy. You can skip that chapter and just stick with the nibble boundaries and life will be good.
Yeah, right. And that's sort of the thing, right? I mean, we had to do that planning with V4, and we had to get really specific about the number of networks that we're talking about. And we just really have these ungranular buckets in V6. And at the outset, we should try to get comfortable with that. And it's very hard to do because you really want to just sort of overthink it.
We're all engineers. We want to dive in and be able to do that technical aspect and carve and slice and dice and look like we're optimizing. And MV6 really just doesn't care. And that's actually, and it's in some ways it's an offense to your engineering sensibilities, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It's sort of like it's an affront to that side of like, oh my gosh, I spent all this time. I've learned how to do this really, really well before. And it's a skill set, you know, that just isn't relevant in V6 at all. Let's say now the great news is you get to spend time working on more interesting things, which I think is the things that we really get to, you know, scratch our head about around some of the aspects around routing, maybe some of the aspects around security. And the address plan is sort of the end goal, reflects some of this, right?
That's right.
We go back and, you know, you were going back and forth in your book talking about like, hey, there's operational principles that we can start to look at from a big picture basis, look at to say like, can we make our lives better and easier as operators to do certain things with our address plan we never had the freedom to do in V4? As operators, there's a whole set of flexibilities that you can do in your address planning that just wasn't available there. And the principal one being, you can delegate responsibilities for whole swaths of address blocks and not be concerned with the details about how they operate those, right? In terms of being, you know, nitpicky of saying like, you must do this with this network segment, or you have to do that with that one because we wrote all these complex rules and we took this all the way down to the, you know, XYZ, you know, slash notation boundary in order to accommodate you. Like all that stuff just naturally goes away. You're like, here's your /48, you know, go use it as you see fit for whatever, you know, if it's a campus topology, maybe it's a building. You're like, okay, you might have to provide a framework for what the building requires for how many, you know, whatever the wireless configuration, handsets and devices, printers, et cetera, but they don't all have to be match every other campus design, because another campus design might have 5 buildings versus 1 building. Well, hey, I mean, at this point, did you have any advice that you wanted to give people around adopting V6, maybe just in general versus the address plan specific side of what we've been talking through?
Yo, you know I do, Ed, and you won't be surprised to hear what it is. It's the advice that we always give, which is just get started. You know, if you've been putting it off, and chances are, I mean, you're at this point now, you probably already got your hands at least a little bit dirty with IPv6. But you know, if it's something that you have felt intimidated by, just know that once you get in and you start making some strides with it, taking some actual concrete steps to deploy it, you're going to find that you know, it's really a lot easier than maybe you assumed it was. There's a lot of stuff that's just been you know, really ironed out of the operational difficulties with the protocol based on how hardware and software behaves. And so you've got, you know, a great late adopter or medium late adopter advantage in that regard. And you'll be amazed at how much progress you make in a very short period of time. And then also, of course, buy my book.
Just ever buy his book. But no, I that's great advice. I think it's very, very much in line with where the industry's at. Well, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. Tom, how can the audience follow you on the internet? You know, obviously we talked a little bit about the book, but, you know, blogs, public appearances, if you got any of them, you know, Twitter handle, et cetera.
Yeah, Twitter at IPv6 Tom. And then I also publish on the Infoblox Center of Excellence website, the IPv6 blog that yourself and Scott Hogue publish on as well.
All right. Well, I'm Ed Horley, E. Horley on Twitter. I want to thank everyone for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. There's a bunch of other great content up on Packet Pushers, Network Break, and Data Knots, and the Full Stack Journey from Scott Lowe. So there's really good stuff up there to go check out. So I encourage you to listen along for any of those others. And thanks so much for joining us and listening in. So until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.